Good evening. This is Dr. Rosarie Griffin interviewing Joseph Whelan of the School of Applied Social Science at UCC. We will be speaking about the area of welfare, the welfare state, the labour market and poverty. This is an area of interest for you.
Yeah, that's right. So I suppose I'll maybe just tell you a little bit about myself.
That'd be wonderful. How did you get interested in this whole area?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a lecturer at the moment in the School of Applied Social Studies in University College Cork, and that's also where I just completed my PhD.
Congratulations.
And my PhD was on welfare and stigma and the lived experiences of people who are receiving welfare and whether or not they experience stigma. So, you know, it's something I've been interested in for a very long time, and something I was always interested in doing a piece of research on. So when it kind of came time to do a PhD, it was, it was quite an actual fit, if you like.
Yes. And so you teach in this area then?
Yeah, so I teach, I primarily teach social work students.
Okay.
So my own undergraduate degree was a social work degree, a four-year undergraduate degree. And I primarily teach social work students, but I also teach social science students, and I teach, you know, and kind of contribute at a number of different levels, both undergraduate and postgraduate. But yeah, we would be kind of covering the development of the welfare state in Ireland and in Europe, and we'd be covering things like poverty and so on.
And tell me, when would you think Ireland became a welfare state as such?
I suppose the story in Ireland is a little bit more complex than it has been in other jurisdictions, in that it's been a kind of rather ad hoc development over a vast number of years.
Okay.
So, you know, we would have had some of the early pieces of welfare infrastructure in the kind of early 1900s, which we inherited due to our colonial status. So we got the old age pension when Britain got the old age pension.
Yes.
But when we separated from Britain in 1922, we kind of rolled back an awful lot of the existing welfare infrastructure. And it wasn't actually until 1947 that we had our own Department of Social Welfare for the first time in this country. And with that...
Who was that as a result of? Can you remember which administration?
Well, there was a lot of upheaval at around that time in terms mm-hmm. of the kind of political kind of parties dropping in and out. But there was a big emphasis and a big push on the need for functioning welfare from the Labour Party.
Yes.
And that eventually was given kind of a policy platform in 1952 in the very first Social Welfare Act. And that kind of more or less then laid the foundation for the kind of welfare infrastructure that we still have today. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, it's developed since 1952, but, you know, it more or less kind of set the stage for what would be the Irish welfare state.
Very good. And tell us, I suppose, what were the main developments between then and now before we go on to COVID?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's been characterised by slow changes over time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always been a very heavy emphasis in Ireland on the means test.
Right.
And that hasn't changed. You know, we've relatively generous rates of payment, but we have a very, very heavy emphasis on means testing people. And means testing is often as much about keeping people out as it is about letting them in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's really kind of been... It's kind of gone along that trajectory really since the 50s up until the present day. And, you know, it's been more generous and less generous depending on the broader economic landscape of the times.
Okay. And how do we fare in relation to other OECD countries? You know how the OECD usually measure Western
yeah.
countries in relation to each other, how well or how poorly we're doing. Where do we rank in the international setting, we'll say?
I suppose we do okay, and it's largely dependent on the measure. So, I mean, most OECD countries measure this using GDP.
Right.
And we measure it ourselves using GDP. We have to, as a member of the European Union, we're obligated to measure using GDP. But GDP is complex in Ireland because of the amount of foreign direct investment in the country, and it kind of skews the figures.
Okay.
You know? So when you look at it as an aspect of GDP, we're actually at the bottom of the league table, if you like, in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were to look at it through GNP, which is perhaps a more kind of fair measure.
Okay, we better explain the acronyms to our listeners just in case they don't. So GDP is gross domestic product, and GNP?
That's right. GNP is gross national product.
Okay.
And what it does is it discounts all of the exchequer returns which are repatriated by foreign countries that operate in Ireland.
Okay.
So, you know, that doesn't count then in the total. So you get a much more accurate and fairer reflection of money that's actually circulating in the country, if you like. And when we use that as a measure, we're kind of around the middle.
Okay.
So we're not quite as good as some of the Nordic countries, which, despite, you know, kind of austerity, are still some of the higher paying countries when it comes to welfare, and we're not quite as bad then as some other countries, so we're kind of somewhere around the middle in terms of our overall spend.
Okay, and within that grouping then, what I suppose groups of people are fare best or fare worst, as the case may be, financially
in terms of welfare recipients?
Yes.
Well, I mean, there's a standard adult rate that most people will receive regardless of the type of payment they're on.
Right.
And then, you know, there's distinctions when you come to pension age between the contributory and the non-contributory pension. So if you get a contributory pension, it's likely to be a little bit more than a non-contributory pension.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the difference there is means testing. So if you're on a non-contributory pension, your means are taken into consideration and you'll get a payment based on that. So it's quite a uniform thing in terms of groups of welfare recipients maybe on different payment trajectories, but they generally tend to come under the same bands of payment.
I see. And we say fast forward to today and the COVID-19 situation. What do you perceive as being, who are, we say, the winners or losers in relation to the COVID, since COVID-19, when the country went into lockdown?
Well, it's been a very interesting time to observe welfare and the welfare state, particularly in respect to income maintenance. So, you know, we faced huge, huge joblessness in the wake of COVID-19. I think we were up at 16% unemployment back in March, and that would have risen since then. It's probably starting to go the other way now a little bit as the economy opens up. But generally speaking, people were able to avail of the COVID emergency payment, which was €350 a week. And this was kind of unconditional. So there was, you know, very little scrutiny. If you had been in work, you were entitled to receive this. And, you know, this was something that you could get whether you'd been in full-time or part-time work.
Okay.
And, you know, it was on the basis of solidarity. It was on the basis of the fact that we needed to do this to help people in this kind of time of crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that started to splinter a little bit since.
Okay. In what way?
Well, I suppose very... I think when it was introduced, there was a sense of we're all in this together, you know?
Yes.
And there was a sense of solidarity about it. But there were some detractors who were talking about people that were perhaps working part-time and were getting the full amount and were therefore perhaps better off than they would have been otherwise. And, you know, that, as the payment has gone on, has become more and more pronounced, that kind of division. And you've seen this in the kind of discourse around the payment emerge quite strongly in the last number of weeks, to the point where the government are now going to introduce bans, different bans of the COVID payment for people depending on their previous employment.
Okay. And I suppose, where will all this leave us? I mean, typically, according to most indices, both women and children fare worst in, we'll say, any poverty index of most countries. Do you think things will be worse post-COVID-19, or do you expect
it's
any
very,
change?
I mean, there's no, you know, I think there's a sense at the moment, because of the fact that some of the restrictions were moved up, that we're exiting this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that we are, in respect of people going back to employment.
Right.
And you're right in what you say, in that, you know, women and generally single parents are almost disproportionately affected by any kind of cuts or austerity. And something that's been very apparent is that people with caring responsibilities, who've also had to try and maintain employment, have, you know, really been put to the pin of their collar in the last number of months. So, you know, there's still a lot of uncertainty out there.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be about getting people back to work in a fair and equitable way. And that could be things like a reduced working week, or it could be things like job sharing. There's also some call and talk about introducing a universal basic income.
Oh, yes. Would you be in favour of that, Joe?
I think done right, I would be, yeah.
Okay.
I think it needs to be examined very closely and very carefully. There's a danger by introducing it that it could be used to kind of precipitate a race to the bottom, you know. So it could be used for, you know, employers could see it as a reason to cut paying conditions, for example, which you wouldn't like to see happen. But at the same time, I think we face an awful lot of challenges, and welfare and how we do welfare is going to be central to answering these. So even things like degrowth and the fact that we can't continue to produce at the rate that we currently do for a whole host of reasons, not least the kind of impending environmental catastrophe, means we need to look at how we're going to actually look after people.
Yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. And that could, you know, a universal basic income could potentially be part of the answer to that.
Mm-hmm. I see. And I suppose in relation to your own research then, have you any particular area that you tend to focus on more than others? Is there any one thing that sticks out for you in terms of your own interest in the area?
Yeah, well, I suppose I'm currently involved in a research process with two other colleagues from UCC where we're trying to capture people's experiences of work disruption. So we've done one survey and we're going to launch another one probably towards the end of this month.
Okay.
And that's just to get a sense of how people are actually experiencing this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in terms of my doctoral research, I was very much interested in lived experience and trying to move away from, you know, fairly typical statistical indicators to actually understand how people experience receiving welfare.
Okay.
And what their day-to-day lives are like and were like and so on.
And what were your key findings, Joe, out of interest? What were your key findings?
Yeah, well, I was particularly interested in the concept of stigma and kind of trying to understand what kinds of things contribute to stigma in respect to receiving welfare. So, I mean, I think there's probably little argument about the fact that receiving welfare can be very stigmatizing. And what I wanted to try and do was to understand, well, what kinds of things make that stigmatizing?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, the answers in some ways are what you'd expect them to be. So things like welfare conditionality. So in other words, the types of things you have to do in order to qualify for a payment and then the things you have to do in order to continue to receive that payment. They can be incredibly stigmatizing. They can be incredibly detrimental to people's well-being and mental health, and they're not conducive to returning people to the workforce in large part, although that's usually the kind of reason that they're introduced. So, you know, this was something that was quite prominent in my own research.
Okay. And did you look comparatively against, we'll say, the Nordic countries who seem to have a better handle on even their perception and understanding of welfare and how it is, you know, the function of it is to assist people, you know, back into playing a full and meaningful role in society. Did you see good examples of that there?
I mean, it wasn't the research wasn't comparative in the main, but at the same time, you know, you're right in what you say. Now, I suppose it has to be caveated, you know, in the sense that there has been austerity in the Nordic countries. The Nordic countries are often held up as being the kind of shining example, and in many ways they were and have been for many years, but they have also been subject to austerity nor different anywhere else in the last kind of 10, 15 years or so. And that has kind of introduced retrenchment and an emphasis on welfare, conditionality and workfare, etc. But they do have a less stigmatized view of welfare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's more of this idea of the welfare commons, you know,
right.
that welfare is a public good that we pay into willingly because we may ourselves need to avail of it someday, or somebody that we know, our neighbour, may need to avail of it. And there's more of a sense of social solidarity in the way the Nordic countries do welfare, as opposed to kind of the UK and Ireland, which would be what would be known as liberal welfare regimes, where we're very selective about who we help. You know, we kind of have residual welfare. So in other words, you're not entitled to it by right. You may or may not be entitled to it after a lengthy process.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. So that sounds quite bureaucratic, in fact.
It can be. I mean, it is.
And soul really, destroying, potentially.
I mean, it's become less so, I think.
Right.
And I think, you know, the pandemic payment was an example of how you could kind of do away with an awful lot of bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. People, you know, applied and were put into payment within 7 days. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I suppose, you know, it's not fair to cast aspersions on people that work in these types of areas too. You know, they do have an awful lot to deal with. But there is a procedure and a process to be followed, and that can often be itself stigmatizing.
Yes.
It's like what I said earlier. I think the means test is one of the most stigmatizing features of a welfare regime, because what it's kind of saying is, you know, you shouldn't be here, you are, but you're going to have to meet all these criteria before we're going to be willing to meet your needs, mm-hmm. you know. And that's the message you're getting from the very offset. And that can't be anything but kind of stigmatizing and laden with the sense of failure.
Okay, Joe, that's very interesting. I suppose before we wrap up, is there any other area that you'd like to touch on or mention that you're involved in before we draw this interview to a conclusion?
No, I think that I kind of covered everything. I feel like I've been rattling on for ages. So,
no, that's wonderful. It was very enjoyable.
Might be interesting maybe to on another occasion to speak about how we do poverty in Ireland, because we kind of do that different to everybody else as well. So,
oh, okay.
We put that in the book for a future one maybe.
Wonderful, definitely. You've already piqued my interest. So thank you so much, Joe, for accepting the invitation to do this interview this evening, and we wish you all the best in your academic work and
Thanks
research.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And there you were listening to Joseph Whelan of the School of Applied Social Science at UCC. And the interviewer was myself, Dr. Rosari Griffin. And these interviews can be found on podcast at CRY104FM.com.